Cemetery Committee, and President represents Martin Farnell, Ellis and Donley, and first man on the agenda is House Bill 100.
What section?
And House Bill 100 deals with victims' rights and makes some revisions of the existing law. To that, we have several people signed up to testify. Mr. Hines, who testified. We do have we've been working on a proposed committee substitute for the bill, and there's several proposed amendments to deal with issues that were identified in state affairs. Identify yourself for the
Mr. Chairman, I'm Randall Hines, representing the Department of Health and Social Services this afternoon. Present the petition paper on committee substitute for House Bill 100. The department takes no position on those matters that would change the civil procedure or criminal proceedings, CSHB 100. We support the involvement of victims in the juvenile justice process with some limits, and specifically the limit to leave the matter of attendance and disposition hearings to the discretion of the court. Attendance to all other hearings, the department supports that.
Okay, so leave attendance of which part of the issue?
The disposition hearing only.
Oh.
Which under current statute, that's the way it's handled.
I don't understand. Under current statute?
Under current statute, the victim may petition the court for permission to attend the hearing. And we're just recommending that for that particular hearing, that we leave it that way. We leave it with the discretion of the court to decide whether the victim attends or not.
Okay. Any questions from the department?
Mr. Chairman, if I could elaborate on that, I think
Mr. Bergstrom, could you just identify yourself?
Sure, there? Tom Bergstrom from the Department of Health and Social Services. If I could elaborate on our concern for excluding victims from disposition is that there are, since the juvenile master has the latitude to consider the background of the offender, the background of many of these offenders have aspects that could prove highly embarrassing to the offender if known, and if the victim is able to learn the circumstances of the child's background, that could pose some severe problems.
What's he talking about?
Yeah, well, I guess, what kind of problems would it
Well,
pose?
I'm thinking of a child who may be in a foster home, maybe an adopted child. His background involves, let's say, homosexual abuse. The kid commits an act of vandalism, and through sitting in the disposition portion of the proceeding, the victim learns that, spreads that around the community. The kid is most likely going to end up on probation. He goes back to the community that's known about him. He could have a very rough time.
Comes in, Martin.
Well, you're talking about the child?
Yeah.
To a certain degree, wouldn't those be confidential in relationship to child or children? And so that probably wouldn't get out even in the discussion. As a lawyer, wouldn't you?
No, true.
Those things, not in the opening, when you discuss the protection of a child within a court room or whatever.
Is that over you?
For the record, my name is Lori Otto. I'm counsel for the Judiciary Committee. You're correct, Representative Martin, that juvenile proceedings are confidential, and this does not change the confidential nature of the proceedings.
While that's true, the victim, if present, would learn those details. and may very well repeat them to other people outside the confines of the court.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Routinely at disposition hearings, there are a wide variety of issues are discussed that may pertain to the minor's family or other parties that are involved with the minor, you know, that the information about the family and the history of the family would be presented at disposition hearing, and then the victim would have access to the information about a family, which is really kind of another set of parties aside from the victim and the offender, in a sense. And so that, I guess what we're advocating is that we want some, looking for some protections of the victim's family and information about the family that may not be pertinent to the crime, per se, but would definitely be presented at the disposition hearing. So I hope that clarifies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your position, is clarified, but I had assumed that these things were protected anyway, even though you may discuss those, that the youth is protected when it's discussed in confidentiality. It's not in this case that you said someone may go out of the confines of the court. Well, isn't there a protection against that if they did?
Representative Martin, I think if we allow the victim in, I don't think the victim's restrained. You know, nobody else would be there.
Right.
It'd be just state officials, the defendant,
right,
juvenile, and the victim. And there wouldn't be so the only danger here that I think the department's raising is that the victim somehow would go outside the proceedings and tell people what they heard in the proceedings, I guess. And that wouldn't be prohibited, I don't think.
Are they warned by a judge?
Well, the judge could certainly, advise them that you're being privy to some very confidential information here. Normally, you're the only party that's accepted under statute. You know, the judge could give them that advice. But I don't think the judge would be compelling them not to provide the information, you couldn't the judge couldn't say it would be contempt of court or something for you to talk about what you heard about here, since they're, they're a party. It would be different, I think, for public officials that are present. Mm-hmm. They have a different duty, right, rather than a victim. I guess the question here is, is that a serious enough danger that the victim would go outside the proceedings and explain to people, tell people what happened, and those people would somehow tell other people, and somehow that would injure the defendant somehow.
Well, I was just going to say that, an easy way to address it is and I think it's certainly the intent that the victim be able to attend the hearing for their own benefit and not to convey the information to other people. And it would be very easy to put in a sentence saying that the victim may not disclose what occurred at the meeting or what occurred at the hearings, and just have a simple statement of that, to that effect, which is, I think, clearly what is anticipated in here.
Something we could take a look at. I just wonder if this is really a big danger. I don't know what the problem is. I mean, actually, I think when these people commit these crimes, because the only way this information is going to be introduced is at sentencing, so they've been convicted. They've been convicted of committing the crime, and then this information comes out at sentencing, okay? I mean, it seems to me like they've kind of waive their big objections to having all this privacy when they go and inflict harm upon other human beings. I'm losing a lot of my sympathy for them at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, the whole process here, I think the goal should also be on the rehabilitation of the victim. And this is important information for the victim to have, I think, in their rationalization and their healing process. So I want to minimize the impact, any unnecessary impact upon the defendant, but I don't want to do that at the price of the healing process of the victim of the crime either. and be different if this stage of proceeding came before the adjudication that they were guilty. But it doesn't come till after they're guilty that these kind of information, this kind of information is even before the court, too. But, I mean, I think we could certainly look at this over the next couple of days, and if there's proposals that people want to bring before and on Friday, we could pull it over till Friday and look at those kind of proposals, too.
I thought we'd get on that one. I should have more faster today, just go.
Any other questions for the department?
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see, if questions, we have somebody from Department of Law, if there's questions for them. Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Frank. I'm here this afternoon on behalf of State Farm, Allstate, and Progressive Insurance Companies to speak to a very limited section in House Bill 100. And I don't, the CS has not been adopted yet, so we're still working off the old.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the. We do have the proposed amendment that I think speaks to your concern, so we have circulated that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you'll recall that this is the subject of some testimony that we had in House Health and Social Services. Our concern here deals with the provision in House Bill 100 that allows the victim of the crime to recover in a civil proceeding treble damages against the perpetrator of the crime. The concern of the insurance industry being that if this is designed to be a punitive type of measure against the perpetrator of a crime, it's not really punishing that individual if that that award is going to be passed along to an insurer. So that issue has resulted in the amendment that has been proposed here this afternoon, and the effect of this amendment, I think, will be to make it clear that in the event a civil proceeding is brought and a judgment is entered against the perpetrator of the crime, that the treble damages aspect of that award is not going to be recoverable against an insurer. That is, the compensatory damages certainly will, but those punitive measures are not going to be recoverable against an insured.
So the amendment, the 40391 amendment, would address your concerns?
That's correct.
Why don't you just go ahead and ask a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if the witness could address the existing state of the law on punitive damages, and I know we added the last sentence to the amendment to make it clear that this bill is not in any way, shape, or form attempting to change the law on punitive damages. And as I'm sitting here rereading it, I'm wondering if saying that it shall be controlled by the contract of insurance might in fact limit the insurance company's liability for punitive damages when there are case law requirements, case law that says that the insurance company is liable for punitive damages unless they exclude it in the contract of insurance. Maybe it would be better to say shall be controlled by the contract of insurance or relevant case law or something like that.
Through the chair, I obviously, if it's the intent of the sponsor not to change the law of punitive damages, I'm almost inclined to respond to your question by saying, why don't we just delete the last sentence altogether? Because it's clear that the Supreme Court has said, for the other members of the committee, perhaps I'll give you some background. This issue about whether punitive damages are recoverable against liability insurers has been debated extensively across the country, and there are generally two different positions on that. The first line of cases will say that punitive damages are intended to be a punishment against somebody, and we're not punishing them if we allow that award to be passed along to an insurer. We're really punishing the insurer, which in effect, because it increases their cost, penalizes all policyholders of that insurance company. So they have said that we will not allow those types of damages to be recoverable under by an insurer. Other courts have said that we are still going to require that insurer to identify their insured even for awards of punitive damages. I can't tell you right now which is the majority rule and which is the minority rule, but I can tell you that our Supreme Court has kind of adopted a middle ground, and they've said that punitive damages can be recoverable against an insurer if the insurance policy does not exclude them. So it puts the insurer in the position of determining whether they're going to allow punitive damages to be recovered against themselves or not. And quite frankly, there are companies, State Farm, for example, that don't, as a business policy, ever write an endorsement excluding punitive damages, even though in states such as Alaska they could. But they don't. They figure they have an obligation to their policyholders, and they've just made that business decision to do that.
I'm not real informed on this, but earlier up here on line 31, it just says a victim of violent crime who has been injured or damaged may recover from the offender covered the amount of damages that may be awarded in a civil action if the injury or damage results from, and it lists all of these things. It doesn't call it a punitive damage.
That's right. It's not. That is not a punitive.
Is that related to this?
Well, it is related to it, but. Okay.
So the damage is in relation to the infliction on the person who's received the brunt of the action. Okay. Punitive, to me, indicates that it's a way of levying a fine on the other person. And this is not a fine, this is in payment for the damage that's been done. Mm-hmm. So it's not a punitive measure, I don't believe.
Maybe. Lori, can you speak?
Right. The point is, Mr. Chairman and Representative Parnell, that anytime you start talking about damages and you start putting in a provision, there's sort of a bunch of little ripple effects all the way around. And so we wanted to make clear that, in fact, this is in the nature of compensating somebody, you know, tripling their compensatory damages, that it doesn't affect punitive damages at all. That's the whole point. And the question is, where it says the insurer's liability for punitive damages shall be controlled by the contract of insurance, the point of that is to say that this bill doesn't in any way affect the insurer's responsibility for punitive damages. It's just sort of clarifying language so that we don't have to litigate it, because this is one of those areas that you can be darn sure is going to be litigated, for the same reason that Mr. Frank is saying we want to make sure that it's clear that insurance companies don't have to pay for these extra damages. We want to make sure that this is not going to be changing another whole area of insurance law that we don't even want to get into in this piece of legislation. The whole problem in deleting the language in its entirety, however, is that you then say that the language, the sentence above says the insurer shall be liable only for the untroubled compensatory damages. And as Mr. Frank was just describing, there are circumstances under which the insurance companies are liable. State Farm, for example, that doesn't exclude punitive damages from coverage, they are liable right now. And so I think that it might be a good idea if the committee wants to adopt this amendment, at least on the last sentence, if we work with the drafters to come up with more specific language to make clear that it's not just liability for punitive damages under the contract that we're not changing, but it's also under the case law. And I think that there's a way that we can work with the drafters to come up with appropriate language.
Okay, but if you want the person to recover from the offender, treble the amount of damage, that's a different understanding, I think, than punitive.
Absolutely.
Well, one way we could do that, and I'm...
It needs to be clear that they don't confuse it.
What about this? What if the third line of the proposed amendment, after the word the insurer, we says, entering its offender, the insurer as to compensatory damages shall only be liable for the untrebled compensatory damages and attorney's fees that would have been awarded under Rule 82. So that's real specific that we're addressing the issue, and because we don't speak to the punitives, that's under existing law left up to the insurance company how they want to write their policy.
Well, I was always going to recommend, Mr. Chairman, that why don't you just take the last sentence and make it subparagraph E? That way, I think that addresses Representative Parnell's concern that the treble damages are intended to be compensatory. We'll just take this off and make it an entirely separate paragraph and let them know that there's nothing in here that's intended to affect whatever award of punitive damages a jury deems to be appropriate.
Okay, well, what we're going to do is work with the drafters the next 2 days and bring this back before the committee on Friday and have this put down a little better. Representative Martin?
Mr. Chairman, I like to make sentence either as sub E or at the end. I think it does clarify it. It made me feel better.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to thank Ms. Otto for working with us on this.
Well, thank you for bringing up the point. We never, you know, our goal here was not to put an extra burden on the insurance company, and I think we can work this out so that we figure that out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I don't know if anybody else has signed up on 100 yet or not. Is there anybody else here on 100 to testify? Mr. Snowden? Oh, yeah, congratulations on your legislation we sponsored that passed the House today.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Court System. Now that I'm on the record, thank you very much for your support of that bill that was on the floor today. I think it will be helpful to the Supreme Court. On the bill before you, CS for House Bill 100, my only concerns, and I am positing, I'd like you to know where I'm coming from, that a judge always has the discretion whether to swear or not swear a witness, including a victim. So I am positing that remains within the discretion of the court. If that is not the intent, or if there's a different intent, I certainly would like to know that, because, but I believe the judge has that inherent power to decide whether to swear someone or not. Based on that, I would like to turn your attention to page 4, line 17, and suggest an amendment after the word hearing. Let me find that.
Which one are you working from?
The CS.
The CS. I would like to insert the language that you use later on in the bill for juvenile hearings, and the language is just good common sense in my book. Pardon? Oh, let me hand these out to you so you have copies. I'm so sorry. Is that all the same?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. I'm attempting to insert language that you have on line 6, on page 6, and to make it a general language, and that's basically if there are numerous victims. The court may limit the number of victims who may give sworn testimony or make unsworn oral presentations. I bring to your attention the possibility of 100 victims that want to speak for 25 days. I think the court needs, within the area of reasonableness, to be able to limit that. So that would be the intent of the amendment I would suggest to the committee.
Yes, yeah, it's the 4291 CS, page 4, line 17 and line 22. Okay. Are there any questions of Mr. Stone? Representative Martin?
Well, Mr. Chairman, not only him, but I had this lined out before he brought it up, and I thought I'd give it after all the testimony, but I really wondered, why are we emphasizing sworn and unsworn throughout the bill? that wasn't in the original bill, and I'm just coming. I always thought a judge and a court had that decision as the situation developed, but you feel necessity to put it in the bill.
Ms. Otto?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Martin, I believe that that language was in the original House Bill.
Oh, it was.
100. And the reason for saying sworn or unsworn, as Mr. Snowden noted, the judge is going to be able to say in a particular case whether a testimony has to be sworn or unsworn. The purpose of allowing the oral testimony to begin with is people can provide unsworn written testimony right now.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people in the state that just don't feel comfortable or capable of expressing themselves in writing. And it's a lot easier for them to come into court and just make an oral statement. And certainly if any party insists on the testimony being sworn, it's going to be sworn. But if nobody insists on it, it's a lot easier and faster for the victim to just stand up and say their piece rather than going through the formality of having them be sworn if it's not requested by either of the parties or the court. So it's just to provide the option, just like we allow people to provide unsworn written comments right now. I mean, we don't require people to get notarized statements and submit them to the court. We let them just provide a letter.
Yeah. But you feel in this case that you have to spell it out.
I don't have any problem at all with the proposed amendment here, and I agree with Mr. Snowden that the judge has the option there to do that. So
he is the judge.
If nobody on the committee objects, we'll try to incorporate that into the CS.
Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
members of the committee.
Is there anybody else to speak on House Bill 100? Okay. Lori, could you walk through the CS with us?
Sure. The first change in the CS is the addition of the language on page 3, lines 13 through 21. And this really goes to the discussion that we were having earlier with Mr. Frank about the provisions of the contract of insurance. We adequately worked out the language in Section C. Section D was not satisfactory to Mr. Frank. We therefore did the amendment that we were discussing, and based on the discussions that we had in committee today, we'll come up with another amendment, probably along the lines of having a D and an E and working out the language. But this is to make clear that the sections here on triple damages don't require the insurance companies and then by reference everybody to cover the costs of assessments of triple damages. The other thing we did is we changed the language from, and it appears on page 3, line 2, line 5, line 7, line 23, where it talks about serious criminal offense. It used to say violent crime, but in the House Hess Committee, based on a request from the Department of Public Safety, a bunch of additional crimes were added, some of which were not technically violent crimes, and like burglary, for example, that does not fall within violent crime, but it is now under this bill. So we changed the term that's used from violent crime to serious criminal offense.
Can you explain on page 4, line 8, number P, letter P on that, and how that would fit?
How escape in the first, second, or third degree would fit? That if you were in the custody of a police officer, you escaped from jail, and somebody was injured in trying to stop you from escaping, then the person who was injured could recover triple damages. And if you look at page...
stealing a police vehicle or anything.
Right, all of those things. If you look at page 3, line 6, you'll see that it's specifically talking about apprehending an offender.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be where it says apprehending an offender who's committed a serious criminal offense, so that would apply to somebody, since escape is within serious criminal offense, somebody who's trying to apprehend somebody in the course of an escape, which certainly is a very dangerous situation.
So this comes after conviction, right? This kicks in after conviction. Because of determination of having committed a serious criminal offense?
Well, this kicks in after you prove in a civil trial mm-hmm. that somebody committed a serious criminal offense.
So what happens, what happens if they're not convicted of that, but they've smashed a police car in the process of escape? Is there a way to handle that?
Well, the first issue at trial would be, have they committed this crime? Okay. There's a, you know, if they had been convicted, clearly that would meet the civil presumption. But then there's a lower civil presumption. So even if somebody wasn't convicted of the crime, if you could prove by the preponderance of the evidence that they committed the crime, this could kick in. You've got pretty good evidence and you probably win in a civil court that the crime was committed, where you wouldn't be able to prove it in a criminal court, right? But still, the burden would be on the victim to make that proof then, and that'd be, you know, that might be a burden that the victim wouldn't be able to undertake. Where if they've been convicted, it's a cut and dry thing. That clearly meets the level of proof in civil court, and it wouldn't be much of a question at that point. It'd be easy to prove.
So they will have been classified as having committed it once they've been through the system, and then the collection can take place.
Right. There's a lot of crimes that take place that are never prosecuted.
That's part of my concern.
Yeah. And this would still allow you, if you could convince the jury that they in fact committed the crime, even though they had been convicted of it, that would push you into the accelerated damages provision. There's an awful lot of assault and batteries are not prosecuted in Alaska.
That's fine.
Okay, the next series of amendments, there's a really long section that's added. Section 13 is new. It starts on page 6, line 26, and it goes through page 8, line 29. And what this does is adopt a provision of the model act that has been promulgated by the National Association of Attorneys General. It's a proposed model legislation on victims of crime, and it spells out the circumstances in which the addresses and telephone numbers of victims and witnesses are confidential. There is, in your packet, a research memorandum from Patricia Young that's dated March 1st, 1991, that spells out all of the other states that have adopted similar kinds of legislation. And the point is that unless there's a need to do so, for example, such as where an address is the scene of a crime, a victim or a witness will not be required to disclose their address in open court in front of the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
Although these police records or court documents are public records under other circumstances, it says that if they're going to be given out to members of the public, the victim's address and phone number has to be deleted. And there's a whole series of provisions that that address the circumstances under which a victim and witness telephone numbers are confidential. And then in the last section of it, which is on page 8, starting on line 17, it places some limits on disclosure of the victim's name in public documents where there's been a sexual assault or child sexual assault committed. What it says is that in the court records that the attorneys have to refer to the victim by initial. That's kind of putting something in statute that most people do already. If you see indictments now where somebody's indicted for child sexual abuse or sexual assault, they use the victim's initial, and that's to avoid causing them additional embarrassment or discomfort.
Back up on confidentiality of victim and witnesses' addresses and phone numbers. I assume that's just for the paperwork involved in the process. It doesn't go to the phone book or the Polk directory or any of those other things. It's simply in-house.
The criminal proceedings. Meetings, yeah.
The next sentence goes on to say it. A report, paper, picture, photograph, court file, or other document that relates to a crime contains the residence or business address or telephone number, and it's in the custody of a public officer or employee may not be available for public inspection. And that's on page 7, starting on line 4.
I guess the keyword there is relating to?
Yes.
Okay, because there are public documents sitting in their offices on the shelf with addresses in.
Right, and beyond that, if you go to page 8, line 27, with 28, you'll see that nothing in this limits the right of the media or the public. It doesn't limit the right of the public to attend court proceedings, and it doesn't limit the right of the media to report information that they've lawfully obtained from some other location. It's just the records that we're creating that relate to a crime are not going to be listing the victim's address and telephone number. And the reason that it's contained in the model legislation recommended by the National Association of Attorneys General is that it's dangerous for the victim in many situations to have that information available to whoever wants to obtain it. And certainly a lot of victims really feel a great deal of concern about retaliation from the person that they're testifying against in a criminal trial and don't like to disclose their address in open court.
I understand. How, in that area, how do those people who need access to that get that? Is there another area of the code that addresses that? People working on cases and things like that. For example, somebody wants to go back to the records for the last 20 years, 21 years from now. And if we change this to where those aren't available, do we have provision for them to go into the records and find those addresses and things if they need to do searches and so on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell, this really only relates to the occult. If you look through the bill, it talks about may not be made available for public inspection. Certainly, it is not going to limit the access to the information by law enforcement officials, for that, or people who are not members of the general public who need it for legitimate purposes. And one of the concerns that is specifically addressed in the section that I was referring to earlier on victims' initials, which is on page 8, starting on line 25, it specifically says that a sealed record of the victim's name shall be maintained by the court so that you don't end up charging somebody more than once for the same offense. So in that instance where there is a possibility of a problem, we've addressed it in the legislation. And like I said, this is taken from the Model Act and it's been adopted, I believe, in one form or another in 21 other states.
There's one other amendment that I wanted to bring before the committee. And I guess my intent is going to be to that if the committee doesn't have any problem with it, I want to hold the bill over till Friday, but I'd like to put as much together today as possible so we could have it available to people before Friday. So to probably have a motion to adopt the CS, then to amend the CS to adopt the court system's proposed amendment, to have that incorporated in it, and then to go ahead and adopt, I think, a version of this amendment for the Mr. Frank's testimony, and also consider this final amendment at that time.
Do you have that photograph?
I just handed it out.
Okay. All right. Good. This proposal would, if the victim requested it, provide that the state would provide the victim with a photograph of the defendant when the defendant was released from prison. It would simply, because a lot of these, you may remember what the person looked like, but it was 15 years ago or 20 years ago. They could change a lot. And it strictly comes from my own personal experience that when people are released, it'd be nice to know what they look like these days, especially if you were the victim of a violent crime. And it would only be required if the victim requested it. And so that's just an amendment that I would be proposing. Representative Martin?
I think I realize the intent of this here, but I'm wondering that, once the person has served their time to society for a crime and so on, then they should be trying to be made whole as much as possible.
to what degree may we be interfering with that individual? He may have gotten a lot of notoriety through the court hearings and pictures and everything else, and they deliberately let the beard come out or whatever they can do to disguise themselves to become a citizen and maybe move away. But I'm worried about their individual rights as private citizens want to release and feel they want to forget the past too. But the pictures are being sent out by them of them.
Well, I'd be certainly willing to limit the uses that this photograph can be put to, because the only intent here is to allow the victim to know what these people look like now.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were to encounter them in a situation, they would have the opportunity to be able to identify them as somebody from the past, right? I would have no problem with putting, you know, limitations that this could not be, you know, reproduced. It could only be used for personal information of the victim.
A campaign brochure photo, anything.
Yeah, nothing like that. So that you know, to try to deal with those kind of concerns, that would be fine with me.
But sometimes you hold a grudge for a long time, no matter what punishment that individual got, and you got the picture, you might just feel, boy, there's no chance of it even. We're all human like that.
Yeah. I think that's a possibility, but I don't think you're going to find too many victims who go out hunting for somebody once they got out of jail.
Sure. So why send pictures out on them?
I think just for the opposite. You may, for the victim's security, want them to know what somebody looks like if they come up to them, you know, at some point in time. So they'll know, you know, that, well, you know, they'd be reminded what that person looks like. I'd be happy to work on this and bring it back before the committee with some exclusions like that limited it specifically to those purposes.
Yeah, it's a victim, because it's made to realize, hey, we'll help you protect yourself, but it's limited.
And I've got no problem with that at all.
Commissioner Hames and as well as Burton both have endorsed the idea.
Yeah.
Is that right?
My head is attached. Yeah, attached. Their position papers are attached. Mm-hmm. And they point out that maybe most victims wouldn't even ask for it, don't want to be reminded. But I think that especially people who have been the victims of a violent crime, it'd be nice to provide them with that option to know what those people mm-hmm. look like when they're released. And with those kind of constraints you've mentioned, Representative Martin.
Would the person being, would the criminal being pulled?
Oh, certainly.
He or she should know.
Oh, sure, that's fine too. We can make that specific if you want to make that specific also.
That way, it may ensure that they stay away from that.
That the prisoner would be informed that their photographs would be provided to the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Is the victim already notified that a person is due to be out real soon?
They are if they request it. That was under the 89 Act.
Which is what's being amended right here, Mr.
Right.
Chairman. Only if they
request it. It's only if you request it. And then it's the victim's responsibility to update their address with the department, too.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Hamlin.
Yeah, just more of a technical thing. It says it must be taken within 3 days of the offender's release, and I'm just, from a practical standpoint, I wonder if that shouldn't be longer. I don't think the difference between 2 weeks and 3 days is that much, but from a practical standpoint, if they know when this guy's getting out, if they have 3 weeks to transfer the guy around to get a picture, that it may be
7 days.
It just seems to me that 3 days, I don't know what kind of processing they go through in the last 3 days, but I suspect there's a fair amount. I don't want to make it tough.
It doesn't bother me at all. If you think a week or 2 weeks would be a better time
frame,
I
would just ask, I guess, the department.
I guess the department didn't really point out any problem with that. Is it better. It would be better?
Bigger window you could give it.
2 weeks.
What do you want?
3 weeks would be fine.
3 weeks?
Not 2 weeks. Any 3 days is, I don't think.
Okay. Normal. Well, what do you think, Representative Hanley? I'm real open on this. You want to go with 2 weeks?
Well, they're going to, I mean, any time that they think is reasonable. Two weeks, 3 weeks is fine. I mean, within that time, I mean, they're gonna, if they want to get out and grow a beard after they eat it or shave, I mean, it's not going to protect it. I think what the main point is to get a picture of the person relative. I mean, if it were even 6 months, it's probably a little change. So, but I mean, just to give them the time that they need to. I would probably say 3 weeks.
Do one with a beard and one without a beard.
I don't have a problem with that. Okay, we'll bring this back before the committee with 3 weeks as the time, and a provision limiting the use, and also that the prisoner be informed that their photographs being provided to the victim. You know, when this would be really, you know, and you know, one of the things we anticipate here also is when somebody's escaped. I think it'd be really nice to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. Exactly. They're provided with the most recent photograph. Exactly. Somebody who's escaped.
Yeah. I'm planning an escape. You want to take my picture?
Well, you know, just their most recent photograph.
The amendment.
I'm going to hold this and work on it and bring it before the committee as an amendment on Friday, okay? Unless the committee doesn't, is that okay with the committee?
Yeah, I'll make a motion that we incorporate this amendment to the proposed committee substitute.
Can we adopt the committee substitute?
I thought we had.
No, we hadn't done that.
Okay. Move that to adopt the committee substitute.
Okay. Any objection? Hearing no objection, committee substitute before us.
Move that we adopt this amendment for the committee substitute and the other two amendments.
Right.
With the understanding they will be upgraded.
Right. Is there any objection? Well, hearing no objection, we'll incorporate those all into a committee substitute, bring it back before the committee on Friday. Representative Martin?
Just one other question. This is old law, but I thought maybe lawyer yourself, being a lawyer, could explain to me why. We're talking about the serious crimes. Normally those have to do with damage and killings and manslaughter and so on. Oh, here it is. Promoting a prostitution in the first degree. This means really victimizing that prostitute, that word. It's like a pimp pushing someone, in this case, or a child, someone using a person as a victim, not prostitution. Okay, that's all I want to get. No problem.
Okay. Then we'll just read,
And I apologize for being late. One other thing that came up, and I had a question I was trying to remember in the HES committee, was this section, I think section 14 under the work draft. And it's the last statement, and it, like, I think I've mentioned it before, that I don't know if anything's been discussed. Or
yes, I can actually address that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, during the HES committee meeting, Representative Hanley asked whether or not we needed to have some kind of, we needed to say that the court could exclude the victims from certain portions of the hearing. I discussed this with the Department of Law, and it was pointed out to me that that sentence, that portion of the section is referring to the disposition hearing. It's not referring to the other portions of the hearing. And those are not the kind of hearings that we were talking about.
Okay.
When the concern was raised. So after speaking with the Department of Law, we did not make any amendments to that section. And I think Ms. Kovich is here. Do you have any specific questions for her?
Okay.
Any other discussion? Okay, we'll hold the bill over till Friday and bring the CS back before the committee at that time. Okay. 101, I guess we're going to hold over till Friday also. We're trying to work out some things with them. But if there's anybody here to testify on it, let's go ahead and take any testifying testimony. Is there any members of the public here? Okay, then we'll go on to 103. Or 102. Yeah.
What's the problem with 101?
They're still in negotiations about what their position is. Department of Public Safety likes it. Department of...
Yeah.
There had been some differences between the departments about the provisions and what the cost was going to be. The departments all met this morning and were able to come to an agreement on the appropriate form of the legislation. The Department of Law will be giving us amendments later today or tomorrow morning to incorporate into a CS to make the bill reflect what the administration wants.
Okay.
And so we wanted to wait until after they had had a chance to meet and agree on what they wanted the bill to say before we brought it to the committee. But they have agreed, right, they have all agreed as of this morning.
Which is a big relief from the way we've seen business before around here.
They love to kill each other's bills.
So. Yeah. House Bill 102 is the lowering the blood alcohol bill. We had a hearing in the Transportation Committee on this legislation last week. We did make...
is this a blue zone?
Yeah, there's a proposed CS. And Laura, did you want to describe the CS to the committee?
Yes. The CS is identical to the original version of the bill, except if you look on page 2, there's a reference on line 13, 14, and 17, 18, and 19, in which reference to .05 has been lowered to .04. If you read section 1, or subsection 1, which is on lines 13 through 16, you'll see that it says if somebody is has 0.05% or less of alcohol in their blood, they're presumed not to be intoxicated. It was pointed out, I believe, by Representative Lehman during the transportation hearing, based on the materials that are in your packet as well, in which studies show that most people are too impaired to drive at 0.05. The Alaska State Medical Association, in fact, wanted us to amend the bill to have it be DWI at 0.05, that it was not logical to have a presumption that people were not intoxicated at a 0.05. So all we're doing is eliminating that and saying that what we say in section 2, which is on line 17 through 23, that the fact that they're at a 0.05 is something the court and the jury can consider with other competent evidence in determining whether or not the person was under the influence of intoxicating liquor. And that is, as I say, based on the scientific evidence that shows that all people are too impaired to drive at a 0.08, and most people are too impaired to drive at a 0.05.
And the other reason for that is that there's a new federal mandate that for any commercial license, 0.04 is the level of presumed intoxication. So it seemed kind of conflicting to have a 0.05 saying you're not drunk at below 0.05, but also have the federal government have us say that at 0.04 you're intoxicated. So we're just lowering this to conform also with that federal standard too. Representative Martin?
I used to have an understanding years ago when we first got into this business, but how many glasses of hard whiskey, how many shots would that take?
Of course, it depends on the size of the
yeah,
person,
of course,
but right. a rough average is about one drink per .02. But the first couple of drinks, different people's metabolism can process,
yeah.
Right? And then, but yeah, what we're getting from the medical people is that this is about one beer or one glass of wine or one shot of whiskey less than it would have been before.
All right.
So that 0.10 is 5 drinks an hour, 0.0 is 4 drinks an hour, if you weigh 150 pounds and it's a normal sized.
I'm a little over that.
What's your dinner?
Probably yeah. Yeah. It's those kind of things that I think are more explicit to the citizens. Mm-hmm. When we're telling them that, look, bartender, whoever you are, don't go over 4 beers, don't go over 5 beers.
And that's something this bill is, we're working with the Department of Public Safety, is for a public information effort.
Exactly.
To basically say, have one less drink. Now, mm-hmm. Before you hit the road, you should have one less drink at least, and that's what this really relates to. So.
But, when the policemen, I think they're doing a good job in this state talking about DWI, but sometimes it's missing. But maybe under all innocence, when you go for a community party or powwow someplace or a party for my birthday, if you know in mind, I better not go with 3 drinks, then that's on the mind. So if in our promos, after 4 drinks, the average person is literally drunk.
Yeah.
And those kind of things help.
Within an hour, within a time period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So. That's the only change in the bill that I was going to advocate for. Is there a motion to adopt the CS?
Oh,
Okay, Representative Parnell, is there any objection? Hearing no objection, the CS is before us. Representative Miller?
Just one question, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy just counting up. There's at least seven different fiscal notes making more. A couple of them from the Department of Public Safety, Alaska State Troopers Detachment, a couple of from them, White House.
Okay.
Which ones of these make any sense anymore?
We have a letter that is in your packet from the Commissioner of Public Safety withdrawing all the previous fiscal notes that have been submitted and submitting a new fiscal note that's dated today, 4391, for $12,500 in both this fiscal year and next fiscal year, which is for a public information campaign. The reason there had been a higher fiscal note submitted is that they were anticipating doing a larger enforcement effort on DWI. And I think that the Transportation Committee and everybody agreed that that was a good idea, but it was really a policy issue separate and apart from this piece of legislation. And if you read the narrative attached to the 4391 fiscal note, you'll see that the Commissioner of Public Safety has said that this bill in and of itself would not have a fiscal impact. So this is the only fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety. I think the Department of Health and Social Services has a fiscal note in the area $43,000 or something
like
that.
They want one more person.
One more person in their
office. According to this, it's listed as one, but then they've got down position two. But I don't know if they figured it out themselves or which one.
But HES does have a fiscal note, and all the other departments have a zero fiscal note.
So in other words, is this bill we're looking at roughly, well, they've got HES has 33,000 this year, 52 next year, so roughly next year about 65.
Assuming that the Finance Committee goes along with the HES.
Assuming, right. But at that, it's only about, at max, be about 55.
And did you want to talk to, if you could come up so the microphones could pick up your testimony and state your name for the record.
I'm Suzanne Perry. I'm with the Division of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and I'm the author of the fiscal note, and the two positions is a typo. That should be one position. Okay.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Save just one more.
We should change that so when we get to finance, yeah, we get the same.
Right. Yeah, we'll correct that. You can give us a revised email.
Couldn't the governor's media director?
The other thing, Mr. Chairman, when they revise it, they may want to put it in the standard form with all the other fiscal notes, because when I first looked at it, it was roughly $24 million starting out at personal service, because they put it in 1,000. Wrote out the entire amount versus putting it in the form.
Could you just give us a revised note that we could give to the Finance Committee? Yeah. Okay.
It's sure like that when you're
I'm going to do it in the Fairbanks. Oh, man, Mike.
Gosh. Okay, is there any other discussion on 103? Okay, there's a motion to move the bill from the committee with individual recommendations. Any objections? Yeah, go ahead.
There's a matter I'd like to address on the bill.
Okay, well, why don't you come up before we do that?
I think somebody wrench in the monkey work.
Yeah.
Ready to go?
Yeah, all ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Margo Knute with the Department of Law, and there was a matter that the committee could take care of that I had brought up earlier, but it somehow hasn't been covered. And that is in Section 2. There are three ways that a person can commit the crime of driving while intoxicated, and the third is while the person is under the combined influence of intoxicating liquor and another substance. That's on lines 6 and 7. Several years ago, the Alaska Supreme Court declared that section unconstitutional, saying that it was too vague. And we can have a meaningful constitutional provision if we add the word control in front of substance on line 7.
Oh, another controlled substance?
A controlled substance. And that's what was initially meant, but...
That was a typo. N-O-T-H-E-R shouldn't have been there.
Oh. So, okay. Well, I'll... Representative Parnell moves that we amend line 7 here to read a controlled substance. Is there any objection? Mm-hmm. No objection. Motion carries. Okay. Thank you.
Don't want to be unconstitutional.
Yeah.
quick move it before you
vote. For 103, yeah. Representative Parnell's motion to move the bill with individual recommendations.
We should have gone that one.
As amended. So we have a new CS then.
You don't know what we did to it.
But quick, before you go. All in favor say aye.
Okay, is there any objection to the motion to move the bill as amended? With individual recommendations? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Thank you, members of the committee. Appreciate it.
Just all right. To sign.
Yeah, so that's all the business we have before us today. On Friday, we're looking at the ethics bill again, so everybody will take your time.
Can we have mental health up at
the same time? Like the same day.
Show me what ethics is.
Tell me what I'm campaign finance too. You want to throw that on?
They won't be any
fun when we're going to do that. Yeah, go ahead and adjourn the meeting.